From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning to you. I'm Ira Melman. Coming your way on this morning's program, the United States expresses deep concern over China's decision to place an oil rig in an area of the South China Sea also claimed by Vietnam. You'll hear more of Michael Lippin's series on how the people of the United States view China. And I'll talk with one of the authors of a new study about what makes many Asian Americans better students than others. These stories and more on this Wednesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States is deeply concerned that China placed an oil rig in an area of the South China Sea also claimed by Vietnam. Comments come as Beijing's army chief, Fang Fawei, begins a trip to the U.S. as part of efforts to increase U.S.-China military cooperation and reduce maritime tensions. Chinese and Vietnamese ships have rammed into each other and exchanged water cannon fire on several occasions since Beijing set up the state-run oil rig last month. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki said Kerry told the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi in a phone call that the move was provocative and aggressive. Those tensions were noted in public remarks Monday by Secretary of State Kerry in Washington during a joint appearance with his Singaporean counterpart, who referred to the relocation of a state-owned Chinese oil rig to the Paracel Islands within Vietnam's exclusive economic zone as the Chinese challenge.
We are particularly concerned, all nations that are engaged in navigation and traffic within the South China Sea, East China Sea, deeply concerned about this aggressive act. We want to see a code of conduct created. We want to see this resolved peacefully through the law of the sea, through arbitration, through any other means, but not direct confrontation and aggressive action.
Well, in response, China's foreign minister says Wang urged Kerry to speak and act cautiously, saying he should be objective when talking about China. China's state-run People's Daily says General Fang's visit is at the invitation of his American counterpart, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Martin Dempsey, who visited China in April of last year. People's Daily notes that the visit does come amid heightened tensions in the Asia-Pacific region, but said the carefully choreographed schedule will highlight both countries' willingness to foreclose military-to-military cooperation. Brad Glosserman, an executive director of the Hawaii-based Pacific Forum Security Think Tank, told VOA's Victor Beatty the U.S.-China mill-to-mill relationship is still in its early stages, but it's getting stronger.
The discussions that we've had with the Chinese indicate that PLA isn't crazy about this process, but because the top leadership of the party, President Xi Jinping in particular, has called for a new type of major country relations, what you see is an attempt to add some flesh to those particular bones, and that includes a mill-mill discussion. Given the tensions in the South China Sea and in the East China Sea, quite frankly, I think what you have is an opportunity for the two militaries to talk, to try to get some better understanding of into each other's intentions, such that the possibility of a miscalculation, of an accident at sea, is diminished. That's, I think, a very important component of this, is trying to, if you will, set the larger context in which, if there is some problem, it can be dealt with. Secondly, there's also, I think, an attempt by the Chinese to demonstrate that they're going to build a relationship with the Americans that is largely going to, at some level, be independent of the particular problems that China has with its neighbors.
Well, Secretary of State Kerry on Monday said he's very concerned about the situation in the South China Sea.
The United States' position is fairly unwavering, and it has been that we are for the rule of law. In other words, the disputes need to be settled in accordance with declared and accepted international principles, number one. Number two, we want to see them resolved peacefully. Number three, we want to ensure that rights of navigation and free passage are respected. At the same time, the U.S. insists that it does not actually take a position regarding the sovereignty of these claims, and therefore, and it's while it may seem like an actual bit of a diplomatic tightrope, it's really not. It's a fairly easily reconciled set of positions.
Glosserman says China sees itself as the aggrieved party, that it is merely defending its historic sovereign rights and national interest. What he says he doesn't understand is why China sees it as its strategic interest to irritate so many of its Asian neighbors. From Hanoi, Marianne Brown reports tension is rising in Vietnam, with the protests reported nationwide amid that country's dispute with Beijing.
According to local newspapers in Hanoi, thousands of workers at Hong Kong and Taiwanese factories in South Vietnam were taking to the streets, calling for China to remove a giant state-run oil rig from Vietnamese waters. A hotel at a popular beach town is reportedly refusing Chinese guests, and Vietnamese tourists are cancelling trips to China. Over the weekend, hundreds of people demonstrated outside the Chinese embassy in Hanoi, with similar protests taking place across the country. More protests are expected to take place this week. Vietnam state-controlled media usually only carry muted coverage of diplomatic relations with China, but this week there has been extensive reporting on the confrontation and the protests. This is Marianne Brown for VOA News in Hanoi.
From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia from the Voice of America. Chinese state media say Beijing police have detained a man for seriously harming China's image by providing false information to a foreign website. The Xinhua News Agency says Xiang Nanfu published numerous false stories on the U.S.-based Boshan dissident news website. It says the fabricated stories included claims the Chinese government harvested organs from living humans and buried people alive. Xinhua said the 62-year-old's actions were instigated and highly paid with U.S. dollars by a man surnamed Wei, who was in charge of the website. Xiang, who was detained on May 3rd, is reported to have confessed to his crimes and has repented. Boshan also covers political scandals or human rights abuses that go unreported in China's government-controlled media. Its stories are sometimes sensational and anonymously written. In a statement, Boshan said it strongly protests the detention of Xiang and denied paying a large amount of money to him. It said the case is another clear sign of the rapid worsening of China's human rights. As they do every year, Chinese police have been arresting activists and government critics ahead of the sensitive anniversary of the violent crackdown on democracy protesters in Tiananmen Square on June 4, 1989. This week, Daybreak Asia is bringing you a new series of reports on what Americans think about China. An audience member recently asked VOA if we could address that complex topic. Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin accepted the challenge and started by looking at the latest surveys of U.S. attitudes on China published by Gallup and the Pew Research Center. These surveys suggested that most Americans personally do have negative feelings toward China, but also don't see the country as an immediate threat to the United States. In the second of several interviews this week, Michael discusses the findings with former U.S. State and Defense Department official Leslie Gelb, who currently serves as a Council on Foreign Relations analyst. Michael began by asking him why Americans appear to differentiate between China as a whole and its relationship with the United States.
I think the personal reaction of most Americans is to what they see and hear as undemocratic China, about China abusing human rights values, and they don't like it. As far as China as a state is concerned, acting in the international arena, we've now, until recently that is, had very little confrontation and conflict with China, particularly of the serious variety. So as a state actor, they see China mostly in historically relatively benign terms, and as an economic partner and competitor.
And regarding the interactions between China and the United States, what would you say are the most significant interactions that we've had in the last couple of years that would shape most Americans' views of China as a country that's relatively benign toward the U.S.?
We don't have much by way of interaction with China about how it treats its own citizens. American newspapers write editorials condemning it. Columnists do. Our government leaders occasionally make statements of disapproval about what goes on there. So there's that level of contact. There is the economic level, which is rather enormous because, you know, we have $1.5 trillion in debt to China, stemming from a trade that's mostly are buying Chinese goods, and they're buying much less by way of American goods. But the trade is quite substantial. And in recent months, I would say the last 6 months plus, there's a new dimension, and that is the typical geostrategic dimension that's been missing these last almost 30 years. And it comes mainly in terms of Chinese assertiveness in the East China Sea with Japan and in the South China Sea with the Philippines and Vietnam and Malaysia.
And has that assertiveness given Americans the feeling that China could take similar approaches to how it deals with the U.S.?
If you took polls of American public opinion right now, you'd see that they're just beginning to shift toward China as a nation from a generally benign view on the part of a majority of Americans to one that's beginning to become wary about just how far Chinese leaders will assert their rights over the islands in the East and South China Seas, because it really begins to smack of traditional power politics, of Chinese asserting their sovereignty over these various islands and beginning to try to back those claims up with military force.
Do you see any areas in which Americans feel that there are opportunities for a more cooperative or friendly relationship with China in the future?
Yeah, it's going to become more difficult, not less difficult, in the next several years. China is an odd case because it is the first global power in history not to be a global military power. Its military power is pretty much restricted to its own borders and the shores off its borders. And there, it's getting stronger and stronger. They increase their defense budget by about 10% each year, close to it, which is far greater than anywhere else, any other country. And so the Americans, and particularly China's neighbors, are beginning to get antsy, nervous about it. And China's neighbors are the ones who have started poking at us to pay attention and to assert protective rights for them and for ourselves in the region. With all the concern I have, and I think Americans increasingly have, over new Chinese muscularity, I still think it is absolutely critical for us to maintain the positive side of the relationship and to keep talking to them and doing things in common with them. Otherwise, the conflicts that are now relatively manageable will become unmanageable and quite dangerous. So there's an incentive to maintain serious diplomacy on both sides.
That was Council on Foreign Relations analyst Leslie Gelb in New York. Our series continues at the same time tomorrow when the head of the Wilson Center's Kissinger Institute on China and the United States, Robert Daly, it's Michael Lippin, how Americans' lack of familiarity with China shapes their views of the country. North Korea has threatened to wipe out South Korea's government in a furious response a day after a Seoul official said the North must disappear soon. The North's powerful National Defense Commission called the South Korean comments an intolerable provocation that showed the South wants to take over the North. It said in a statement carried by the state media that North Korea will launch all-out merciless strikes to wipe out every last person in the South Korean government. South Korean Defense Ministry spokesman Kim Min-sek said Monday that North Korea wasn't a real country and existed for the benefit of only one person, a reference to its leader, Kim Jong-un. He said the North has no human rights or public freedoms. Kim's comments followed a series of slurs by North Korea against the leaders of South Korea and the United States. North Korea's media likened the South Korean president to an old prostitute, and President Barack Obama to a monkey in recent dispatches. South Korea's defense ministry said North Korea's military had not undertaken under any suspicious activities. A ministry official said South Korea is always ready to repel any provocation by the North. South Korea has been highly critical of North Korea's nuclear and missile programs, including recent rocket and missile launches and apparent preparations for a fourth nuclear test. However, the comments from Seoul Monday are stronger than usual. South Korea tries to avoid publicly talking about anything that could be interpreted as a collapse of the North Korean government because of worries that the North would raise tensions. Well, our weekly Daybreak Asia poll is out and running on our program page at voanews.com/daybreakasia. Thanks to all of you who weighed in on a sensitive and emotional question last week. We asked this. After a bombing in Urumqi, Xinjiang, Chinese officials blamed the violence on Uyghur extremists who want to separate Xinjiang from China. However, Uyghur rights groups claim religious suppression drove Uyghur people to commit the extreme acts, which standpoint do you agree with more? Well, almost 36% responding said they agreed with the Chinese government, but agreement with the Uyghur rights groups captured just over 46% of the vote. About 12% felt both sides have valid points, and a little more than 6% were not sure of the whole thing. Well, this week we'd like to know what topic would you most like Chinese President Xi Jinping and South Korean President Park Geun-hye to touch on in their recently announced upcoming summit in Seoul. Your choices are nuclear threats from North Korea, tensions in the South China Sea, the country's relationship with Japan, economic ties between China and South Korea, or you may select not sure. Votes are already being cast, and the poll will remain open through Monday. So why don't you stop by and tell us what you think at voanews.com/daybreakasia. Or at our VOA Asia Facebook page, where we've surpassed 200,000 likes since we recently updated and expanded our page. We thank you. As always, Daybreak Asia polls are not scientific, but an interesting reflection of what our audience, you, is thinking about current issues and developments in Asia. It is not new information that Asian American students are high achievers. They tend to get higher grades, do better on standardized tests, and go to college and succeed there more than their counterparts in other groups, including whites. What is not so clear, however, are the reasons why. There is a story of the Asian tiger mom who puts great pressure on her children to succeed academically. However, a new study shows there's more to it than that, as well as a downside. I spoke with one of the authors of this new study. Amy Sin is the lead researcher of the project. She's an assistant professor of sociology at Queens College at the City University of New York. We spoke via Skype.
What we're saying is that Asian Americans have a distinct kind of cultural orientation towards education, and that in part explains their advantage. But the story doesn't stop there. I think that if you do a careful reading of the literature, we find that what is missing from the discussion is that Asian Americans in the United States benefit from a variety of resources that are not accessible to other immigrant groups and white Americans as well. And that includes positive stereotypes and community level resources. For example, you know, in a poor disadvantaged immigrant arriving to the United States now without any formal education themselves, without knowledge of the U.S. educational system, arrives into a Chinatown in New York or California, and they have access to very rich resources in these communities. After-school programs, tutoring programs, information networks about where the best high schools are, about, you know, what are the tests that you need to take in order to get into the best colleges. We do find that there are these cultural values that matter, but there are also resources out there that are uniquely available to Asian Americans that allow them to kind of realize their cultural beliefs and their cultural values. That part of the story, I think, has been missing from the discussion because we tend to attribute too much to values and culture. I mean, the culture and values, they are necessary parts of the equation, but they're not sufficient to fully explain group-level advantage and achievement.
Can you boil this all down to, you know, if you're a non-Asian or non-Asian American kid, just work your tail off harder?
What we find is that Asian Americans are more likely than their white peers to believe that one achieves not due to inborn ability, but one achieves due to hard work. So hard work, effort has a payoff. And so they're much more, Asian Americans are much more likely to hold this belief than their white peers. And in general, as a general statement, people who subscribe to that philosophy tend to see challenges as, every time they meet a challenge, as a cue to increase effort. They also are more likely to work harder when they're faced with challenges. They're less likely to see failure as signs of, as indication that they should stop. They're more perseverant, and they have more intrinsic interest in the task at hand. So as a general philosophy, yes, these beliefs that effort has a payoff and effort is really the reason why one succeeds as opposed to being born innately smart or innately intelligent, those are important values that lead to positive outcomes.
But there is a downside here, if you are to view it as a downside, and that is, your study also showed that emotionally in other areas, the Asian and Asian American students are not as happy as their counterparts.
Yes, and this is a very serious issue that I don't think enough attention has been paid to this. The fact that mental health is a serious concern in the Asian American community. Rates of depression, rates of youth having suicidal thoughts are highest among Asian Americans than in any other non-Asian American college age group. In part, that is can be attributed to the incredibly high educational expectations we place and pressures we place on Asian youth today.
What in your background is applicable to this study personally?
I'm a immigrant to the United States as well. And I definitely feel that growing up in the United States within the Asian community, there was a lot of pressure to succeed, and that has led to people striving and achieving, but it's also led to a lot of, I think, people who, friends of mine who fail to achieve, they feel less Asian. And I think that is unfortunate, because there is this idea that to be Asian means doing well in school. And when you don't do well in school, or when you do average or above average, that's not valued enough. That's, you know, and then they feel less Asian, and that leads to being unsatisfied with one's life. And I think that's a shame.
If I'm not mistaken, you are now a parent. How do you think you will address this as far as your children are concerned?
Wow. Well, you know, I do think that I will pass down to my son the importance of education, the importance of trying, the importance of working hard. I think as a general rule, that's something that I'd hope to pass down to my children.
Amy Sin is the lead researcher of a new report into Asian American students. She is an assistant professor of sociology at Queens College at the City University of New York in New York City. Make sure you join us next week at this time for another report on international education. Thanks so much for joining us today on Daybreak Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Stay with us for the latest world news on International Edition. It's coming up next on many of these same frequencies. Enjoy your day.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese, and then look for VOA News Chinese Edition. With this application, you can